Hey, everybody, Patrick Connor here, and welcome back to the Knuckles and Gloves podcast. I'm back with my boy Aris Pina, CompuBox operator, and of course, fight historian like myself. And we're doing a fun show today. We're doing a slightly less serious show today, man. The world's got a whole lot of serious shit going on. We don't need any more serious shit.
Yeah,
it was Aris' idea.
It's really dark. It's really depressing, guys. Let's have some fun today.
Yeah, dude. So we're here to remember some just fun and hilarious, funny memories that just we remember during our boxing fandom. You know, put a number to it, don't put a number to it, whatever. We're here to just remember some fun, funny shit. Aris, how are you, bro?
You know, I'm doing all right, bro. Everybody's struggling a little bit out there. We're all, you know, it's the winter time. It's still a pandemic. There's a lot of shit going on, but hey, man, we got through January, all right? That's at least a start.
got through the first month of a new year that was like, you know, already
never ending. Yeah,
it was like kind of nightmarish. 2021 mm-hmm. was nightmarish. So, yeah, it's nice to, you know, do some light shit, some levity.
Exactly. That and I would say we have a really good, you know, a bunch of fights to look forward to this weekend and a really exciting. So, yeah, man, you know, everything is all right. I think I'm doing okay today.
Well, the boxing world hasn't stopped. You know, the real world hasn't stopped.
There's, you know, before we get into what we're going to talk about, man, there was already enough shenanigans from last weekend from past subjects that we've had and other stuff going on. So the boxing world definitely does not stop. Talking about Don King, obviously.
Yeah, man, no joke.
6 decades of corruption, bro. I mean, that should be a Guinness record, right?
Man, you know, I mean, that's like, hold on, we got Duran fought in the
1960s, 70s, 80s. We got 70s, 80s, Don started in the 70s. So 70s, 80s, 90s, 1000s, 1010s.
It's a wonder. It's a fucking wonder. 6 decades
of corruption with Don King. God bless the man.
Yeah, just like our...
I say that sarcastically, obviously, but, you know.
Our buddy Corey Erdman made a thread about it the other day, and you know, the poster for the fights and everything, it's definitely a throwback to the days of GeoCities shit. I'll tell you that much, man. It was awesome. But
and there's a dude, I want to give the actually credit, the 6 decades of corruption was to a buddy of ours who listens. Twitter name is Reggie Dunlap. You know, he's the one who originally said that, and that's absolutely true, man. That shit was hilarious, bro. Like, Don at 90 years old is still. You can't help. I mean, I don't want to laugh about it like it's funny, because I mean, you know what I mean. You can't. It's that's done.
Yeah, man. It's well. I mean, and I guess it's not really that much different from what any of the other promoters are currently doing in terms of ethics or anything like that. But
it's just that Don's been so synonymous with this over the years. Like, well, when you think of corruption, you think of craziness and BS.
And he dropped off the map. Like he's basically dropped off the map as a top promoter. Whereas, for instance, I mean, I don't want to just like beat around the bush, but like Bob Arum is going to be the other older promoter who's been around for fucking ever, but he's still promoting. He's still doing shit. And he's still, you know, with Top Rank, and Top Rank is still extremely in the mix, obviously. Whereas Don King Promotion's like, you know, on the fringe, not even on the fringe and shit. So that's a big reason why it's like a story, and why it's like, holy shit, it's a comeback. It's weird. But, you know, Don King might even figure into some of the shit that we're talking about today, you know?
I mean, some of the subjects I want to bring up were definitely promoted by Don King. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it's in our lifetime, if it's something that's happened, you know, while we've been fans of the sport, then I almost assuredly there's going to be some connection to Don King one way or another.
Yeah, for sure. So speaking of, what would be something for you, for example, that you just off the bat that you just like, holy shit, or you just thought was like hysterical, whatever it may be, because
dude,
boxing's been filled with it, but we've been fans, we've been fans since the 90s, that's 2010, 20, this is our fourth decade even, which is crazy enough.
Well, and I mean, yeah, like for context, I guess somebody might be like tuning in and being like, why does it even matter that like these, you know, who the fuck are these guys? I guess we're not really anybody per se. It's just we've been boxing fans for a long time, and we obviously pay pretty close attention to stuff that goes on and stuff that's happened in the past, obviously. But yeah, I mean, we've just been around the sport for a long time and have done our fair share of paying attention. And so that being said, one of the funniest things that I can remember, and this was, gosh, you know, I'm actually going to have to pull this up because I didn't pull up any of the particulars about it. I just kind of thought about it and was like, holy shit, that's hilarious. But wow, okay. I felt like it was like 2007, but apparently it was 2010. And that was the day that Kermit Cintron went flying out of the ring against Paul Williams, dude. I mean,
that was bad, man. I was working that at HBO that day for Punch Zone. I worked both of the Cintron. I worked both of the controversial Cintron fights. One were where Sergio Martinez knocked him out, and Cintron said it was a headbutt and got away with it.
He somehow talked his way into not taking that count. Like, what? What? I've never,
It was a headbutt.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen a fighter successfully argue and like have it be like, okay, hold on, reset. Like, I don't think I've ever seen that before. Yeah. And in this, on this occasion, I mean, like in context, dude, Kermit Cintron's kind of seen as like a bit of a whiner, somebody who is like, won't accept his losses. And, you know, in retrospect, a lot of people, I think, look at his losses to Antonio Margarito, and right or wrong, dude, I'm not making any judgment on it. I'm just saying that I think that a lot of people look at those and they're like, oh, well, those are excusable now. At the time, that was not the thought. At the time, that was not the prevailing opinion. The prevailing opinion was that Kermit Cintron was a puncher who just like was not tough. You know, you folds under pressure and shit. But putting him in with Paul Williams, who, as we, you know, all knew, was a warrior and shit like that, but was kind of like, you know, had to be retested and stuff. You know, he had lost to Carlos Quintana. You know, there was a lot of questions about Paul Williams, and going into this fight, I remember a lot of people were really anticipating it, because one is at the venue that we now know as, you know, hallowed ground at then the Home Depot Center, but now it's the, what is it? Health Sports something or other, but yeah,
what it's actually known for.
Yeah, and now it's the place everybody knows, where like if you want a war, dude, you go there. And so a lot of people were excited about the fight because of that, and then they were excited because it was a matchup between, you know, two fairly top guys, and it unfolded pretty good too. Like the first couple rounds, it looked like, dang, like Kermit Cintron came to fight, dude. Kermit Cintron came to do some shit, and then he decided to punch an ambulance. I mean, dude, I don't know exactly how this happened. I just know that they got tangled up, and Kermit Cintron went from like, he could have just, I guess, ran into the ropes, or I guess tripped and kind of, yeah, it would have been awkward falling out of the ring, but he like somehow angled himself. So he's like, he dives and goes, whoop,
he
like,
oh, pretty quick, man. I mean, I haven't watched in a long time, but if he did, it was a pretty precise right through the ropes and
like, yeah,
crashed through him. Yeah,
he definitely had some momentum. It's been a little bit since I seen it, but it was like he had some momentum.
One of the original, like, almost, I wouldn't say GIF because GIFs weren't around back then, but like the photo when you were making a joke of something, how you were feeling after or start, whatever it may be, and then they showed Cintron on a stretcher being taken out.
Yeah, with the neck.
With the neck brace.
Yeah, he's like,
yeah.
He's
on his way to lose that fight, no?
What's that?
You think he was on his way to probably even losing that fight regardless? Williams at that point, I don't think, was regressing. Was this before he fought Margarito or after?
See, now I'm going to have to look at this just so I'm not like dumb and say something bad here. Kermit Cintron. Yeah, so he had, yeah, so this was immediately before the Martinez rematch for Paul Williams.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he lost to Carlos Quintana, and that was like, you know, that was a significant loss, but obviously, you know,
Quintana fought the best fight of his life that night.
Yeah, that was, he basically put everything all together, and then Paul Williams like destroyed him in the rematch. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's kind of obviously gets X'd out. But needless to say, yeah, going into this fight, it was, I don't know, I felt like it was highly anticipated. But if you look at the video again, it's like you can see that the Kermit obviously does have kind of like momentum because he's tripping, like they're falling to the canvas. But he goes from kind of like I've been drunk, you've been drunk, like falling forward, like stumbling forward, to just like Superman straight through the ropes. And he goes and like almost looks as if he hits his back on a table or a monitor or something like that. It looks like it hurts. I'm sure it didn't feel good. But then he goes and he hits the ground and goes from grabbing his arm to like, I can't remember what it was, but he went from his arm to something else to his neck. And so then they're like, oh shit, you know, oh, his back. That's what it was. He's lying on his side and starts going, like, dude, I'm sure it hurt. Like, he probably scraped his back on the fucking monitor or something. But it was just hilarious, the sequence of events, like that it like unfolded so quickly. And then they immobilize him, they put him on the thing, and it's like, oh shit, like maybe he's really hurt. And just as they're loading him into the ambulance, he's like, kabah! And starts punching the side of the ambulance while immobilized like a mummy, dude. And he's like,
I'm gonna have to rewatch this, man. It's been a while.
I'm telling you, bro, it's the comedic value in this is highly underrated. And now, especially now that we know that he was totally fine, nothing happened, nothing was broken.
Hey, Mom, said all that, right? Yeah.
Oh man, and I don't have anything against Kermit Cintron, but
look, bro, he was an entertaining fighter for his time, and he had legitimate power, and he had some entertaining fights, whatever. But like that one, and like we mentioned, the aforementioned Martinez fight. I mean, it's interesting that they fought, you know, both against Williams Martinez, but like the antics that happened in both of those are just kind of comical in itself for what happened. Absolutely.
And as a side note too, right around this time, right around possibly a little before it, but right around this time on the Max Boxing forums, Kermit Cintron had split with Marshall Kaufman, and Marshall Kaufman had gone onto the Max Boxing forums and was just talking some of the vilest, craziest shit about Kermit Cintron around this time, like all the time. It was pretty hilarious.
Max Boxing, Boxing Talk, those were the gossip sites in the early late 2000s,
yeah,
early 2010s and stuff, bro. If you wanted to pay a fee to get the latest Floyd Mayweather little bit or what was going on Boxing Talk, or to catch that sparring footage on Max Boxing, you know, that was a good $5 spent if you had it back then, right?
Yeah, dude, you do the whole year for $50 or whatever.
Whatever it was, but I just remember those things, man. Boxing Talk would have like the little blogs up there. Oh, exclusive interview with Mayweather, exclusive interview with this one or that one.
Yo, what's good? Yo.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
I remember. Hell yeah.
So this one predates me actually becoming a fan a little bit, but I'll consider it because I saw it on the Tuesday Night Fights compilation anyways when I was a kid, and I thought it was the most hysterical thing I had ever seen. And that was when a former Olympian named Anthony Hembrick got absolutely annihilated in his hometown against a fighter who was absolutely jacked to the gills. There you go. Yeah. Named Booker T. Ward. An unassuming guy, by the way. But Anthony Hembrick, a former 88 Olympian, very, very decorated amateur. He didn't make a big splash in the 88 Olympics, which was surprising in the least. But at that point, though, he was an undefeated pro. He showed a lot of promise. He was a lanky boxer. You know, he had a lot of pedigree to himself. And he was being featured on USA Tuesday Night Fights at this point in 1990. You know, this was one of those when network boxing was still very prominent, not as big as it was in the 80s, but Tuesday Night Fights was big. You sell at ESPN, you know, everything was, boxing was like, was very, very healthy. And this was a showcase fight for him, especially because it was being held in his hometown, and it's being held in front of his people at Fort Bragg, where, you know, he was was he a Marine or was he in the Army? And so
pretty sure he was a Marine. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think.
And so, with all that being said, like, you know, this was supposed to be a showcase fight for him, you know, as he moved on to contendership. because he was a part of that fresh 88 team. It's only been a couple of years since the Olympics. He's shown a lot of promise since then. He's been featured as well as his other, you know, former Olympians, and Booker T. Ward was having none of it. But what makes this so absolutely hilarious, and if you listen to this, I'm sure you remember this too, because it's that memorable, is the antics before the fight that really just brings it all down. My man broke it down. This is 1990. So he gave you the best pop lock, new jack swing, hybrid rap. I don't even remember the music because you can't hear it, but they just had this whole routine down, looked like straight out of Beat Street or something you see out of Soul Train from that era. Straight up. It was very impressive. Don't get me wrong. I'm not even trying to laugh at the moves. Like, they had this all down. Him and his hype man, which definitely wasn't his cut man. It was just his buddy that was holding a towel and probably squirted water for him. But they had this whole routine down, the type of routine you haven't seen since, I'll throw a random name out there from the 80s. Another guy who got blitzed, by the way, his name was Alvin Too Sweet Hayes. Do you know that name? You remember him?
You've talked, yeah, I'm pretty sure you're the one who's brought him up to me.
So yeah, back in on the undercard of Tommy Hearns, the segue really quick, on the undercard of Tommy Hearns, Roberto Duran, Alvin Too Sweet Hayes from Detroit, not affiliated with a Kronk gym, by the way, but still from Detroit, an undefeated, very, very popular guy, and lanky and just very flashy. He was getting ready to fight Jimmy Paul. He had the most ridiculous dance routine before the fight. It was awesome, by the way, too, all right? He was wearing a pink, like, you know, he looked like a superhero or a villain, whatever you want to call it, but it was like a pink robe, the bandit mask, all this other shit going on, the whole nine yards, right? And he starts dancing around. Him and his boy break it down and smooths and moves even probably slicker than Hembrick, by the way. Like, this was a really, really good one. And then Jimmy Paul completely annihilates him at round six, just splatters him to the canvas. And unfortunately, you can't find that footage on YouTube and you can't find it anywhere else online. I know a couple of people who do have footage of it, but it's just one of those fights that's kind of like, you know, unless you have the full broadcast of the Hearns Duran card, which is kind of rare, you're not going to see it. Anyways, back to what we were just talking about, it's the same thing now. You know, I mean, 6 years later, Hembrick kind of does the same thing. It has the full-on dance routine. Instead of six rounds, though, he gets splattered into one round.
Yeah, dude, he even better is that, like, it's almost kind of like it slowly devolves, too. Because right as the bell rings, he, like, slips in his corner because there's water. Because they're sitting there, you know, squirting water on him, fucking around for forever pre-fight, and then he slips on the water right as the bell rings, and he's like, oh shit, like he almost acts like he hurts his knee or something like that at first, like he's kind of bouncing around like, damn, my leg okay? And then Booker T. Word's just like, yeah dude, we're not fucking abiding by this shit tonight, and just,
no, not at all, man.
Just totally fucking smacks his ass to oblivion.
And Word wasn't a guy who was like a slick boxer or anything. Like, if you've seen the video, he's just a very stocky, bulky, like strong, you know, guy like that. Like, kind of around the height of, I would say, Julian Lederlow or like Dwight Cowie in terms of like stature, right? Maybe a little bit bigger than them, taller.
Almost, like almost kind of like a Grady Brewer or something like that. Yeah, just like a.
He was really like
built stocky, and like physical.
Very, very strong, very physical guy. And he came right out there and you just see it, man. Boom, bow, bow. And Hembrick didn't know what hit him. And Hembrick, you know, to hit, unfortunately, like, not only when he would get knocked out, like, it became like, if you watched his career, it became a trademark that, like, his face always contorted in different ways whenever he was getting whooped on. Like, there was a photo of him when James Toney was beating him up in the around 95 or so. And you always just see it, he's like, he was just, you know, he had like different facial reactions that you can totally see that he was getting like worked. And that was basically what Ward did to him, man. It was a shell shock. And I mean, it always makes it more memorable that not only after a whole routine like that, you just get completely smoked in front of your hometown crowd, in front of your buddies, your family, everybody out there after that whole thing. And not only that, the USBA title was on the line. And as we've discussed earlier in other shows, that was a legitimate belt as a, you know, to move on to a world title at that point. So, yeah, man, that's about as big as L as you can take at that point.
Yeah, dude, it was a very public L and basically like, you know, an early L. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially because of his amateur background, like you said, like this was a dude who was very decorated and like expected to go places. took totally a massive
fucking hit. He was just one of those guys. There's always, in every Olympic class, there's always a couple of them that just don't pan out for whatever reason. And some don't pan out a lot worse than others. Like the ones out of the ADA class, you would have to say would be, as we just, as would be Andrew Maynard, would probably be the biggest bust of that class. And then Hembrick. Off the top of my head, I'm sure there's a couple of others, but like Maynard definitely, because he was a gold medalist and had a lot of problems, all of everything else, and just his career just kind of fell apart. But that's a story for another time. And then Hembrick, he never really recovered after this fight too. Like he still, you know, he had a string of wins here and there. He would do things, but in terms of just, you know, really having like a full on career and the promise that he might've had originally, nah, never panned out for him.
No, especially how talented he was, dude.
Yeah, very.
Yeah, that shit's an all timer fucking as far as like clips though, no question.
Well, that's why it was always featured, man. Whenever Tuesday Night Fights would always like talk and like show random clips to do something, that would be one that they would definitely show, and rightfully so, because it's hilarious. You know, when you do a stunt like that and you get all wild and, you know, breaking it down very impressively, again, don't get me wrong, it was very good, but if you get smoked right afterwards, that's on you, bro. You got to eat that shit.
Yeah, that's pretty unfortunate. Got to live with it, dude. Take that
fucking absolutely out.
Another guy, speaking of fucking not being able to take an L, one of our favorite, you know, hilarious boxing moment characters of the last like handful of years, Victor Ortiz. Victor Ortiz, dude. I mean, you don't even know which moment I'm about to pick, because there are so many ridiculous moments. And when I say ridiculous, I mean like the guy, he's a lunatic.
Use whatever word you want to use for him. A very talented fighter in his time and made for a lot of entertaining fights, but man, that dude is out to lunch.
You just didn't know what he was going to say from this interview to the next. You have absolutely no fucking clue what the guy's going to do in the fight. And I mean,
he even had hints of it early on too, when he was like just kind of winning on Delahoy, you know, on different undercards and all that. There was just something a little off.
Well, and I remember seeing him too, and I'd have to look to know exactly which cards you know, I'd seen him on. But regardless, point being, the moment that is probably the most hilarious to me is an early moment, or an earlier moment, and probably the first time that we really got a glimpse of like, holy shit, what is this guy into? And that was the Maidana fight, the post-fight interview of the Maidana fight, because like, dude, that was a great fight. You know, Marcos Maidana is, obviously, since then has shown, you know, he's like a ridiculously tough character. He's you know, better than we thought he was, especially at the time, and et cetera, et cetera. But going into this fight, Victor Ortiz was obviously the prospect or the person to, you know, that we thought was just going to be winning and blah, blah, blah. I didn't really know that much about Marcos Maidana, and back and forth fight, trading knockdowns, et cetera. And I, you know, even after something like that, you wouldn't really fault any fighter for just about saying just about anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's a pretty, I don't even know. They probably shouldn't even have interviewed him, I guess. Like, I think since then, a lot of promotions and a lot of broadcasts have learned, like, maybe if a fighter gets stopped or knocked out, don't interview them. But regardless, they interviewed him. I feel
bad when some of those guys get interviewed immediately after getting knocked out. Like,
it's become a meme. Even in like the UFC, it's become a meme now where Joe Rogan's like, you know, interview like,
there's a car crash victim, and Joe Rogan's absolutely. Like, I've seen that. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's ridiculous, dude. Like, this person just got their fucking head pummeled and they're not thinking straight. I've been in that position. Like, I've gotten my ass, I remember, and I'll just real quick, got my ass kicked real bad one time. They're like, yeah, can you write down what happened? Or like, can you like write down, like, what? I remember just thinking, like, I can't even fucking like think right now, dude. I can't imagine somebody putting a fucking microphone in my face and being like, yeah, so what do you think about blah, blah, blah? Regardless, without fucking, you know, sympathizing too much with this crazy ass Victor Ortiz dude, they still like that post fight interview. He's like, yeah, you know, I don't think I deserve to be getting hit like this. And I remember thinking at the time,
I remember that. Wow.
What? What does that mean? I don't understand. Wow. What did you think was going to be happening this evening? But yeah. And then also the other awesome portion of that, that I remember I edited together in like a Vine or something like that years later, was he goes, and hey, and you know, hey, like he says that like 13 different times during that like 2 minute interview. It's great. The guy is an absolute crazy ass. And so that interview to me is definitely one of the better moments. Especially because it got lampooned so hardcore right afterward, and that was like the earlier days of Twitter and shit like that. Mm-hmm. That was great.
What I remember most about that is that I was actually, I think that was the first fight I was working ringside as an actual CompuBox operator.
Like, oh, really?
Training, but yeah, I think that was the same night. Yeah, because while that night was going on, if I remember correctly, I think that same night I was working in Atlantic City when not Waterman, Walt Marquez, but the dude who sparked on Ponce de Leon.
Lopez? Manuel Lopez?
Yeah, Juan Manuel Lopez. I don't remember who he fought that night because I'm not looking up at the moment, but it was on a pay-per-view card that Aaron put on, and Jorge Arce fought on the undercard, and you know, and a fight that thank God ended really, really, really quickly, which is, it was Yuri Foreman against Canine Bundridge. Because after like two rounds, I realized that fight was absolutely atrocious, and I think everybody did, and like, we're just like, thank God it just ended as quickly as it could, because I was just,
yeah, dude, Canine Bundridge was in a couple bunglers, that's for sure.
Yeah. And so, but I remember everybody ringside getting news that Ortiz like quit during the fight. I think Rayfield was there and a bunch of other people were there, where everyone's just kind of like, oh, did you hear about Victor Ortiz? Ortiz lost, he quit, oh my God. Like, shit was wild, man, you know. And to see all that, like, it was cool to kind of see everybody kind of getting the news at once and like kind of experiencing that, and everybody just kind of like, you know, oh no, and like going over and like talking and getting like trying to figure things out and all that. It was interesting. It was really, really cool.
Yeah, dude, it was that was, like I said, the kind of like the earlier days of Twitter and like finally, like before then,
that was the early days of Twitter, like super early.
Yeah, like, well, or boxing Twitter. I think, dude, I think
Twitter in general, for that matter, I think. I mean, well, Twitter was around, I don't know when Twitter.
I think that shit came out in like 2006 or some shit, but I joined in like 2009.
Boxing Twitter, I would say, yeah, that's when I started too, boxing. No, it was 2009.
And that's like 2009, 2010 is when it really started kind of like picking up. Mm-hmm. And yeah, dude, before then it was like you had to sit there and fucking click refresh on the goddamn forums. Like, for like, you know, news, for somebody to post some shit, and then they'd crash because everybody's clicking refresh on the forums and shit for the news. So, I mean, yeah, having Twitter around, and that was definitely a big development as far as like catching news and shit like that. But yeah, that was pretty wild. Cause like I said, Victor Ortiz was, I'd have to look back. I'm not 100% sure, but I think the year before that he was the prospect of the year. I'd have to look again.
You're probably right. I mean, Ortiz had a lot of hype going on for him at that point. Like, he was featured on the De La Hoya Pacquiao undercard. He was featured on HBO Boxing After Dark before that. After that. And he had there was a lot of momentum going for him. And so at that point, when he fought Maidana, that was supposed to be like, you know, his big coming out party where he was going to be a prominent player coming forward. But, you know, that was an awesome fight, though. That was a really, really, really good fight. And that was a good fight in a point where I'm not sure if Boxing After Dark was really producing that many bangers like that either. So
let's see. 2009 prospect of the year. Wow.
Was that a Rayfield prospect of the year?
Maybe it was 2008, but in 2009, the prospect of the year was Brandon Lee.
Brandon Lee. Oof.
Oh, okay. Canelo was 2000. Oh, it was 2008. So, all right. No. So maybe I was wrong. I totally made that shit up. And Victor Ortiz wasn't prospect of the year whatsoever, but nonetheless, whether he was or not, like he obviously was going into that fight, the favorite and like, you know, considered a promising fighter. No question.
No, absolutely, man. And for the fact of basically like he, like I just mentioned, like all the momentum that he had going on at that point. I think on the De La Hoya Pacquiao undercard, he knocked out Jeffrey Resto. Am I right?
That I'd have to look. I'm not sure, but I remember he
knocked out. Like Resto was another guy who had like a lot of hype going from at one point, but Ortiz like smoked. Yeah.
He knocked off a bunch of like Arnaudis, Resto. Like
that's what he knocked those, off like, Resto, and then I think Arnaudis was on Boxing After Dark because I was in HBO studio working that one too. That was like the early days of Punch Zone when we were like tweaking out the system and everything. But regardless, I would say Ortiz was probably Golden Boy's biggest prospect at that point. That was like the guy they were grooming for superstardom, you know, at least in the late 2000s, right?
Yeah, like no, for sure. Yeah, no question.
So that was that. I guess that was the first of many of what would become of Ortiz's career after that, because you know he made for an entertaining career. Don't get me wrong, but he also made for just a wild one where he never obviously reached his potential because he went from that. He had that memorable fight with Berto that he came out and won. I thought he was going to lose that. I'm sure other people did too, but he ended up winning. And then the Mayweather fiasco and all kinds of other stuff since then. And just, I mean, you know.
Yeah, dude, it's like I said, it's like been a nonstop fucking cornucopia. That's what it is. It's a smorgasbord. That's what you get with Victor Ortiz. Literally anything. But yeah, it's been entertaining. That's about it.
So this one, I'm not sure. I'm not going to say it was actually funny, but it was just something I watched live with my dad. And we were both just kind of in awe of the whole scenario because it was just like, holy shit. And we never, I mean, I'm sure he's seen stuff like that because he's been around forever. But me as a kid, I was 11 watching this, and that was the Bull Galata riot.
Oh man, I mean, yeah, like I guess it was kind of funny. Well, it's funny in retrospect,
but some parts of it, man. I mean, it was pretty crazy to see, but like it's funny. Yeah,
live, it was.
What I say funny is that like how just so unprepared MSG everything was ready for that night. Like they just didn't, like obviously they just didn't care because no one was there. There was no security. There was no nothing. There was nothing. Like, that's what I find kind of funny. It was just like, they don't, like, there was literally nothing there to prepare for what could have actually been there. If you think about what was going on, if you think about, like, the crowds, you know, the fans that were there for that night and stuff, that type of deal, like, these dudes brought very rowdy, into, you know, very rowdy crowd bases. Bo with his, you know, with his people and his fan base from Brooklyn and, you know, in New York in general, and then Galata with his fan base and stuff like that. It makes for a very combustible atmosphere, and no one even thought about it beforehand because there was so little security, there was so little lack of preparation, whatever it may be. And then the fight actually happens.
Dude, it's the shit, like the entire backstory. And I mean, we've talked about Riddick Bowe plenty. We've talked about all the shenanigans and shit like that. And I mean, I guess nobody possibly could have predicted that Andrew Galata was going to just totally lose his mind, I guess. I mean, if you studied his backstory, maybe, but I mean, nobody really knew he was going to do what he was going to do. Not like that. But knowing Riddick Bowe, knowing all of his entourage and the people that he was always involved with and had in his corner and shit like that, dude, I mean, it was almost kind of like, you should have seen something coming. You should have seen something coming that, like, you know, or I suppose you should have seen that if something happened that you wouldn't have been able to do shit about it. But yeah, that entire situation devolved so quickly. And then, you know, the legendary nights when they did the legendary nights, that was part of the series and shit like that. And they had Lampley on there talking about like a little bit more of the backstory of, you know, his portion of it. Yeah, dude. That probably would have been scary as shit, especially being there.
Oh, no question. Especially if you're like, you're not a part of the fan base. So like, you know, you're just there working the event. That's going to be scary as shit. Of course it's going to be scary. What's interesting is that, like, you know, the more you think about it, I think they just kind of thought of this fight as an afterthought that Bo would just kind of smoke him. Because at this point, Bo was in a little bit of a resurgence. You know, even though he already started having the handle of him being lazy and coming in out of shape a little bit and having, like, lethargic fights against Larry Donald, Buster Mathis, Herbie High to a degree, he was on the upswing. Like, he had the third Holyfield fight, which, you know, back and forth, he ended up stopping Holyfield. And then, you know, the way he demolished Jorge Luis Gonzalez and looked really good in that fight and looked like he was in good shape for that fight, too. It looked like Bo was on his A game. And Galata wasn't like Galata was really featured on television much at that point, right? You know, you saw him on Tuesday night fights. Like you said, he already had a reputation of being dirty beforehand because it was a fight on Tuesday night fights against Samson Pahua, for example, where he took Pahua was putting some work on him and Galata in desperation decided to bite on his shoulder, you know? And there's that famous or infamous for that matter video. You see Pahua like lean back in pain after Galata decides to hop on him and then, you know, he ends up stopping him eventually. But anyways, it was, you know, Bo was a prohibitive favorite and it was supposed to be just kind of like a routine fight in front of his hometown crowd. But instead, you know, Galata put on one of the best performances of, like, probably one of the more impressive performances you would have seen at that point. Like, no one expected that. Galata was, you know, he looked incredible that night. I mean, Bo came in incredibly out of shape, too. He had nothing, and he was probably already past it from the past wars that he had, now that we know more. But Galata really was whooping on him, man. You know, he had fluid technique. He was moving well. He was jabbing. He was right-handed combinations. Bo couldn't do anything with him. Galata, like, there wasn't a round where Bo was able to do much with him. Galata was just whooping on him easily. And you got the sense that, like, this could be in the basket for him. But then every so often, especially early on, you'd be like, pop, 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 hits him with a three-punch combination. Boom, hits him low. Kind of looked at my dad. Why do you do that? Dad just kind of looked at me, shrugs his shoulders. I don't know. And then we just keep on watching. And then a couple of rounds later, Bo, and he started realizing, boom, 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 pop, pop, hits him with a combination. Bo goes down. I'm a kid. And I was like, I look at my dad again. He was, and he's just shaking his head at the TV, like kind of saying, what the hell is wrong with this guy? You know what I mean? And then moving on again, moving on, pop, pop, pop. Pop, 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 hits him with a three-punch combination to the groin. I look at my dad again, and I'm like, why is he doing this? I was like, he's winning. And my dad was like, I don't know, this guy's out of his mind type deal. Like, and now he's more entranced me, like, kind of like, shut up, kid. I'm just like, really? And before you know it, he ends up DQing himself. And as we've grown to know Galata over the years and realize how much of a maniac he is and how his brain works, we realize that, like, anytime anybody shows any type of, like, resistance to him, he kind of resorts to, like, doing some dirty shit. And that's what he ended up doing with Bo. It wasn't the fact that Bo was really, like, competitive with him that night or really fighting back. It was the fact that Bo was still there, and Bo, like, every time he hit him with his best, Bo was still kind of standing. So Galata had to resort to a low blow with him a little bit, you know, something like that. But whatever it may have been, none of us were prepared for what was going to happen at the end of that fight. So, you know, it was already a surreal evening that you can't believe what you're watching. Galata's clearly in control. Bo is completely out of shape. He can't do nothing with him. But Galata is losing this fight in a fight he has in the bag. He's throwing it away because he can't stop hitting this dude low. And as he finally hits him with the final combination, Bo goes down. This was a legit one. Galata hit him with two body punches, then a left hook, a mean left hook right to the groin that Jerry Cooney would have been proud of. Bo goes down again, and that's when all hell broke loose. And that's when we were just like, that was like probably, because I didn't watch the LA riots live. This was like my LA riot, practically. Not that violent, but, you know, I'm trying to say, like, I was just like, as a kid, because right before you know it, all of a sudden in the ring, here comes Rock Newman, Bo's infamous manager, the guy that's always caused trouble beforehand, done some other dumb shit beforehand, way before this. he walks in, and the first thing he does is points his finger and says, "Get him." You just see him yell his voice. And then all of Bo's posse starts pouncing.
Dude, I actually, that's one of the few things that I actually remember watching that shit live. And yeah. I think that I watched it with my stepsister and her husband. I'm pretty sure that like I went over to their house and they had gotten it or they were watching it or something like that. But regardless, it's one of the like few things that I actually remember watching live from around that time, even if I wasn't like a big fan then or whatever. But I do remember watching that shit and being like, what the fuck is this guy doing, dude? Like, I don't understand. To this day, nobody understands. To this day, he still hasn't offered an explanation that I think that really makes sense beyond, you know, he just wanted out of the fight, dude.
I think whole resistance thing, I think it was the fact that Bo wasn't going to go down. And he was like, Bo was taking a tremendous amount of punishment. Absolutely. Like he took a lot of punishment, but he wasn't going down and just, you know, laying there for him. And Galata, as he showed before that, if you show some resistance to him,
yeah, he just didn't react well to it.
Yeah, he doesn't react well to that type of stuff. And
Layman Brewster.
Oh man, I just watched that the other day. Brewster absolutely smoked his boots,
bro. Yeah, our dude Jay Seklow uploaded that shit.
Yeah. But that was for the next 20 minutes. We were just entranced on the television, man. That wasn't for me again. I was 11. So the summertime, I was just entranced. I'm just watching this. Like I couldn't believe what I'm watching, man, because it wasn't being stopped. You know, I had seen like fights break out in the ring before that, but they usually get scuffled and just kind of like broken up relatively quickly, you know? And
yeah, that shit was like, there was like a brawl here and then a brawl over here.
Yeah. There was like pockets of stoppage. You know what I mean? It wasn't just like a full on riot for 20 minutes and the whole place just exploded. It looked like it was quelled for a minute. And then you would hear people saying, looks like the riots, you know, people are finally calming down. All of a sudden you see someone, pow! Catch him with the right hand, and then the whole place would explode again. And then it just wouldn't stop. But, like, again, there was no security. There was no really nothing going on at the Garden. And, like, you, when you mentioned earlier about the legendary knights, I think the guy who was in charge, the police chief, whoever it was, I don't remember, but he had no idea until he turned on the news and heard there was a riot at the Garden. Then he was like, holy shit. And then he started making phone calls to get it quelled.
Yeah, dude, like, yeah, the whole, like I said, they say more about like exactly what was happening on the legendary nights about it and shit. And yeah, dude, that shit was like the perfect, luckily nobody wound up getting, you know, there weren't like more serious injuries and shit like that all told, because it was like the perfect fucking storm for something.
Yeah, if you watch it, man, some dudes were getting walloped with some shots, bro. Like it was vicious. But the last thing I'll say about it, man, and there was a few people that will attest to this that were there. George Foreman saved a lot of asses that night.
Yeah, the don't do crew. It, son.
Yeah, exactly. That's when people were approaching and George was standing there and was like, don't do it, don't do it. Who's going to step? I don't care who you are. You ain't stepping to George Foreman.
Yeah, I mean, especially at that point, what was that, like 95, 96? 95, something like that. I mean, that was just 2 years after he'd won the heavyweight. Like nobody
he was still lineal champion shit. At that point. He hadn't lost to Shannon Briggs yet. Yeah,
nobody's gonna do shit. Oh,
brought up Shannon today, Briggs. Let alone back then. He's gonna crush your skull into a powder.
Uh-oh, brought up Shannon Briggs.
Oh no,
somebody's gonna get mad.
Nah, but straight up, man, like he ain't gonna step to George. That's why the most perfect place.
Me?
I think Jerry Cooney wasn't far away over there either. Even I remember Lou Del Valle was in the background of a video while the whole thing was going down. Like, what a crazy scene, man.
Yeah, man, that shit devolved pretty bad. Then, like the only other there were a handful of LA fights like that had riots afterward. Like another one was Chucho Castillo or Lionel Rose versus Chucho Castillo. Yeah, that shit was pretty bad. But I mean, still, that's going back like a lot of years. But I got another Galata one on my list.
Okay.
Or I guess I should say it involves Galata. This is a funny one for sure. And it also involves some Massachusetts, so you'll get a good laugh out of it. So several years after Bo Galata 1 and 2, Andrew Galata is having a career comeback resurgence himself. You know, he's he had kind of gone away for a little while, and then when he had come back, he actually looked pretty good. I mean, he never really looked that bad as a fighter anyway. Like, it was just that he imploded. Like, he looked pretty good. It's just he couldn't handle the fucking pressure. But then he had come back, you know, he winds up fighting his way to a few different title shots, because the titles are spread around, despite the fact that Lennox Lewis is, you know, Lennox Lewis is the champion. And then when he retires, it just kind of, that fractures everything. But
and he hooked up with Don King, and at that point, King still had some pull.
Yeah, and so Don King getting a hold of, you know, trying to work Haseem Rahman back into the picture, you know, and like he's putting on these pay-per-views with John Ruiz and Rahman, Chris Bird, fucking Deverell Williams, all these fucking fools. And anyway, on one of these cards, John Ruiz winds up fighting Andrew Galata. And I mean, I think that at this point, John Ruiz has kind of earned the reputation of being somebody who like just won't go away, whether you don't like him, whether you do like him. And just, I don't think that I knew of one single person who actually liked him for him as a fighter. They would just be like, yeah, I root for him because he's like from a mile from where I live or some shit.
If you watched his fights at all, it was because you were hoping his trainer Stoney was going to do something stupid.
Well, and that's precisely why the Galata fight lives on in infamy. Because
I know where you're going with this.
Stoney himself was like, the guy was, is he still, he's still around. I'm sure we would have heard about
Stoney's
it.
Stoney's still kicking. I'm not really active in the Massachusetts scene, but they would probably know more than we would about what Stoney's up to.
I'm sure he's still involved with all of the really young children and not cussing at all in the gym whatsoever. But I mean, you know, the guy was just what the fuck he was going to do. Like what was it? Alton Merkerson against Roy Jones. At the weigh-in, or if it wasn't the weigh-in, then it was like,
it was a
face-off. Something.
It was a press conference. It was something going on, but yeah.
And, you know, you guys, you motherfuckers. All sorts of shit, you know, steps up, and then Alt Merkerson just fucking gives a whap. And then next thing you know, like, you know, Stoney's showing up to the next press conference with like a bandage on his head and shit.
No, I mean, you know what was bad about that? He ended up shaving his head after that for some reason.
Yeah,
and then you see his big pimply ball. I don't know why.
Yeah, so somebody like nicked his head 19 times, so he's got like his head looks awful.
Yeah.
And it was oh my god, it was
awful. I'm just like, dude, are you serious? Yeah.
He looked terrible. And but he had a history of being everybody involved with John Ruiz had a history of being extremely defensive about John Ruiz because he had a style that was boring as shit. There was a ton of clinching and a ton of rabbit punching. I mean, and watch, I'm probably going to get a fucking message or tweet or something about even just saying this on this goddamn podcast. 100% serious, not joking whatsoever. Fucking his attorney like was threatening me on Twitter and shit a while back. I was like, holy shit, dude, calm down. It's not my fault. He sucked. It's fucking boring. But like, that's exactly the problem, was that like you'd watch him and it wasn't generally entertaining. People usually were not fans and they were just waiting for him to get knocked off. And then finally here he fights Andrew Galata and people are kind of like, ah, fuck, dude, Galata, he's not going to do anything. It's going to be another instance where Ruiz basically, you know, 1-2 jab or a jab grab, you know, 1-2 grab, does that on his way to fucking winning a 12 round decision. And it's going to be awful. Lo and behold, Andrew Galata starts timing him fairly early and gets him down twice. And it's like, oh shit, dude, Galata might fucking take his title. Holy shit. And over the course of the fight, dude, you know, Galata's getting kind of rough because, you know, Ruiz would hold. Like he'd get hurt and he'd fucking reach to hold and then he'd start rabbit punching himself. And so Galata started rabbit punching him back and started kind of getting physical with him and throwing him around and shit. And so Stoney started losing his shit in the corner, and he starts yelling at the referee, Randy Newman, you know, like, oh, come on, you gotta fucking do something to this cocksucker. What the fuck is wrong with you, you motherfucker? Like, I mean, like, really unloading and shit. And then finally, at some point, he like walks Ruiz to the corner because Ruiz is like hurt, you know, so he like walks him to the corner, and fucking Stoney's losing his shit. And he's like, oh, come on, you cocksucker. What a fucking piece of shit you turned out to be, and all this shit. And Randy Newman like walks back and he's like, dude, you say this shit one more time and you're out, dude. And he's just like, you're not doing your job, ref, you're not doing your job. And he's, Randy Newman's just thinking, like, he's even got a smile on his face at a couple of points because he's just like, how can I take this fucking guy seriously, bro? And then finally Stoney gets, just, dude, Randy Newman just has had it, dude. He's like, get out of here, dude, like, you gotta go, you're gone. And he goes like, what'd I say? I didn't say nothing. And he's so like,
you're in charge.
Right? Yeah. And so he fucking, yeah, points to somebody. And then the funniest shit about this is, like, a round later, they cut to a camera between rounds, or during the round or some shit. And Stoney's watching the fight from the locker room. And he's going like, this guy, I didn't say nothing. This guy didn't do nothing wrong.
He's like a manager perfectly. And you know what the funniest thing is? That Randy Newman would have beat his ass from up end the from
yeah, one he had end like a foot of height on him, dude. And he's just like, what are you doing?
Randy Newman was a fucking fighter from the was a heavyweight in the 70s who fought a pretty good, like, you know, who's who of guys back in that era and didn't have a bad record. All right. Newman definitely would have whooped him.
Dude. And Stoney's just thrown every
not to see him after the fight, because Newman would have cooked his grits quickly.
Yeah, every fucking Stoney called him everything but a fucking hole in the wall. It was like, Jesus, dude, he just unloaded on him, and then he's just like, what'd I do? What did I do? This fucking guy.
You can't make that type of stuff up, man. But, like, yeah, man, Newman absolutely would have stomped him like down. This would have absolutely annihilated him in a real fight, like we saw Murkison doing to him.
Should let Galata go after him.
I'm saying, but like you mentioned, man, Galata had himself a nice little run at that point. Like, he fought after he fought Ruiz, he fought Chris Bird, and it kind of ended after Lehman Brewster smoked him really quick. That was the end of it, because that was Don King's last heavyweight he tried to match him up with, and that was that. But that was a kind of weird, but, you know, interesting run in the early 2000s, where, like, Don had those marathon pay-per-views, you remember? That was, like, kind of HBO affiliated, where and they had Ruiz, Rockman was on that, I think Mayorga, Spinks, like, all kinds of different fights. But
that was one of them. Was the, it was like the Night of the Champions or Night of Titles or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was like four or five different, like, championship fights, but it was like, just, it was just the style matchups of, like, four of the five fights were just awful or something. I can't remember which one it was, but I just remember there was a couple of them back to back that were just, like, just terrible. I mean, Don King actually had himself a pretty good run in the 2000s. And then
he really did. I mean, everybody,
the cruiserweights, look,
you know, Don's name is relatively fresh after this past weekend. Everybody says, you know, likes to mention his run in the 80s, which obviously you have to because of the names he was affiliated with. But Don had an incredible run in the 90s, which, you know, people do credit him with Revenge of the Rematches and other pay-per-views he put on. But like you did mention, man, it's not like Don just, like, stopped promoting around, like, 1998 and you never heard from him again. He was still going strong up until, like, I don't know, 2006, 2007. He was still, you know, putting on consistently and still on television. And it was kind of after that he started falling off considerably. But up until then, especially in the early 2000s, it wasn't like Don was going anywhere. He still had a very high number of fighters. So,
yeah, dude. You know, he had the cruiserweight division locked up for a number of years there in the 2000s.
And he still had Trinidad for, you know, in the early 2000s and other, you know, main fighters. Yeah, Don was still doing his thing. But another one I wanted to bring up was one that, again, I've seen in a highlight video from back in the day and stuff. I just kind of found it absolutely hilarious. And but it still talks about a guy that was, like, you know, current in our fandom from early 2000s champion, So Sean Bay Mitchell, when he got his trunks pulled down, this goes back to the same episode.
Yep. Bazooka Limon.
Bazooka Limon. Yeah. So Sean Bay Mitchell at that point, this was going back to 1990 again. So now it's what, 32 years ago, basically, more or less, whenever the fight took place. Mitchell's an up and coming, you know, young prospect. I think he was around 13-0. And Bazooka Limon is a grizzled old veteran who by 1990 is beyond washed. I mean, he's fought everybody at this point. You name him, he's fought them. He had the incredible words with Bobby Chacon, concluding with their maybe the best fight of the 80s in his loss for the junior lightweight championship. He fought Arguello. He fought this one. He fought that one. He fought everybody. Wouldn't lose a draw. And like Limon wasn't like no guy that was like a very like. And
it's almost like tough for my brain to even like grasp that like Sean Bay Mitchell and like Bazooka Limon.
I know what? It doesn't make sense, but then you see how long he fought. And there you go, you know.
That's crazy.
When I was a kid and when I saw a clip of it, I didn't really think much of it in terms of like the difference there. But as an adult and I see it, I'm just kind of like, why? Anyone like Limon who fought as long as he did, had no business fighting near anywhere close to 1990. But, you know, you should have retired in the early to mid 80s, after the Chacon fight for that matter. But anyways. You watch the fight and Mitchell is in control. I mean, it's not a very exciting fight. Limon, like I said, is completely washed and Mitchell is still a prospect. He wasn't, even as like a seasoned champion, he wasn't Mr. Exciting. Would you say, right?
Mitchell?
Yeah.
No,
he was a good fighter and he was compact and stuff, but he wasn't a guy that like, you know, really made you.
He was like, if you put him in against the right style, if you put him in against a fighter who was going to always come to him and like be aggressive, he could be pretty fun. But otherwise, he was like a, you know, more of a slicker type of precision guy.
So putting him in with Limon at that point, I mean, that's just more or less like a glorified sparring session. But it's aired on Tuesday Night Fights, or I think it was still Tuesday Night Fights in 1990. And Mitchell is just kind of going through the motions until Limon, you can tell he's bored, he's annoyed, and he knows he's not going to have a chance of winning, decides to have a little bit of fun. And that's when he kind of grabs up on Mitchell, and you see him in the commentators, Al Albert and Sean O'Grady, I think it was, they notice it, and you see Limon start grabbing on him a little bit.
Yeah, because he gets a couple of tries
and then he finally pulls it down and then you know you just see Mitchell's poor like tidy whitey Hanes or whatever he's wearing with his cup, and it's just, that is embarrassing, but it's also hilarious.
Yeah, dude, I remember seeing clips of that back in the day, and I want to say it's on YouTube, but I'm not positive.
YouTube. It is definitely.
Yeah, I remember seeing clips of that back in the day though too, and I mean, I guess the whatever, I don't really give a fuck who's wearing what, but one of the funny things is Sean Bay Mitchell, like years later, was one of the fighters that would wear, that helped popularize the I don't know how you'd even describe
the trunks them. That was just like, it yeah, was like shredded.
Tassels, like, or
the tassel trunks, tassel
I guess trunks. I mean, I don't know what you call them. They were like, if fucking, you were like, flaps.
No, they were just straight up, they were just flaps, there was nothing.
Yeah, there was no actual trunk, they were just flaps.
Like Camacho, like
interlocking flaps.
Like Camacho was like started the kind of the trend, but I can't recall Camacho actually wearing trunks like that. He wore similar ones, and so did Mildred Taylor, I think, for the Terry Norris fight. But they were, you know, trunks that were kind of, I want whatever you want, like, you know, more kind
like
of
loincloth-y. Like they almost look like a loincloth or some shit.
Yeah. But Sean Bay, that was especially in the late 90s. That became like his, that became his thing.
Yeah. And I think and other Chop Corley like, started doing that shit too.
Chop too. There was other fighters who started doing it around that time too, but Sean Bay was the first one. And he did it right when I remember he wore those trunks against Khalid Raliu when he won the belt, and he kind of wore them subsequently against other guys too.
But damn, like, maybe he started doing that shit so motherfuckers couldn't pull him down.
Pull them down again. I mean, yeah, everything's just kind of right there in the open, right?
maybe it just fucking worked that way, you know?
But I was just kind of just like, dude, really, you know, and it's embarrassing. Limon just kind of did it to be an asshole, obviously, and just kind of like show him up because he was getting whooped on, but it's still funny nonetheless.
I mean, it's, I guess looking back, like, I don't know why you wouldn't just like disqualify him. Like, dude, what the fuck are you doing?
Like, yeah, or at least
just take go home, off, bro. Right? What are you doing?
They didn't do nothing. They just kind of pulled his trunks up. Mitchell looked embarrassed because he's young, and Lamone, you see him, he kind of throws his hands up like in like he's happy that he scored.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, everybody look at me. He's like, hey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, and then he goes back and taps gloves again, like, hey, I'm sorry for doing, like, you know, but still, it was an asshole.
Yeah, you've been trying it for 30 seconds. Sorry, fucking dick. Yeah, and speaking of dicks, but this one got his comeuppance for sure. Although I don't know if it's 100%, you know, balanced out karma wise because of the person who dealt out the comeuppance. But nonetheless, I do remember the lead up to this fight back in 2002. Yeah. De La Hoya Vargas.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember the fucking lead up to the fight, dude. Shit was so hilarious. This is just almost everything about this shit I remember so fondly. I guess just because of the time it was in my life, but also just the shit that happened. Because I was actually rooting for Vargas. I mean, I don't know, almost everybody I know was just, but I didn't really know a shitload of De La Hoya fans. Mostly it was like the perception was that Vargas was tougher. Vargas was more of a badass, you know, et cetera. And De La Hoya was softer. He was coddled more. He was always, you know, the fucking Olympian. He's softy, whatever. But I remember some of the fucking trash talk from Vargas leading up to the fight, dude. Because Max Boxing covered the fucking fight so closely, and they like sent video to the press conferences and shit like that. And so I remember that this was one of the Hopkins Trinidad was probably the first one I remember, but this was right around that time. And one of the first times I remember a fight, like in the entire promotion being covered, like in depth, and getting to see video from like all of the press conferences, like from like start to finish type of shit. Like you'd usually see like clips on the news or something, right? Like you didn't get to see the whole fucking thing, or like maybe you'd read chunks of it in the paper or in a magazine, but you didn't get to see like the entire press conference. And so anyway, I just remember
read about it. You never actually got to see it going down. Yeah.
This was right around the time where you like, you know, finally, because of websites and shit like that covering them, you got to see the press conferences or more of them anyway. And I just remember clips of fucking Vargas trying so hard to fucking clown De La Hoya. And one of the things he said was, I mean, especially now in hindsight, it's like cringe as fuck. But at the time I remember cracking up, he says that over here, we got the ferocious squad and all these dudes like flexing and shit. And he's like, we got the Peter Pan squad over here. And he starts talking like, he's like, I want to be a real boy. And starts saying all this sorts of like Disney shit to De La Hoya, who's starting to actually get really mad and shit like that. And he's like getting into his head apparently. But like, but one of the funniest things is that how tough Vargas is acting and how much shit he's talking. And then someone finally gets it out of him and they're like, why the fuck are you so mad at Oscar? Like, what happened? And so he's finally tells this story where he's like, yeah, like we're in Big Bear and Oscar's in Big Bear too. And we're both training and I slipped in the ice and I was sitting and I was laying on the ice and Oscar De La Hoya like ran by me and laughed. And I was like, you're so mad because years ago he ran by you because you ate shit like a dumbass and he laughed, and like you've carried this much with you this entire time, and that was literally it. And they asked Oscar and he was just like, I don't remember this whatsoever. And at that moment I was just like, Vargas is fucked. This guy's fucked because he's been living this moment and Oscar doesn't even know what the fuck he's talking about. Oh no. But that was just some of the funniest shit to me. And then, so then having him finally, you know, after all this shit, after looking like a dumbass, like getting his ass kicked. And then on top of that, testing positive for steroids, and not only testing positive for steroids, but like one of the most basic steroids that has been like testable and findable for like decades. Total idiot.
I mean, that there's a photo, I think it was in Ring Magazine, of him and the guy that he was, that was like his personal trainer, and they were both flexing. And Vargas is one of those guys like Chavez. They're not shredded. They don't have those type of bodies that are just going to be like made to be like, you know, shredded from head to toe. And Vargas was shredded in that photo.
I remember that shit.
Yeah. You know what I'm talking about? And I'm just like, I remember even looking at back then, like, I'm just like, that just doesn't look right, you know? And then, like you said, after the fight, not only did he get knocked out, he put up a hell of a fight. But
he did, yeah.
He did. It was a very, very, very good fight. But Oscar, you know, eventually came through with that left hook at the end, man, just walloping Vargas and dramatic the way it was. But,
yeah, like one of those knockdowns where the dude, it's like he almost like whips to the canvas. Like yeah, doesn't like fall, but he's like, rah! Like it's like there's momentum.
It was very, very heavy. And to watch the way he got dropped like that, man, was some crazy shit. So it was like, it was a dramatic ending. And then to see Oscar finish him off and Vargas's head kind of like a pinwheel just, you know, going around.
Yeah, dude.
Like, that's like the typical Oscar ending, too, when he gets a guy on the ropes and he starts throwing the flurries and that's how they just have to kind of, like, stop the fight. And...
Well, it's... Yeah.
That's like a double L because, yeah, like you said, man, he tested positive soon after that. And his career, again, he still had big fights after that, but he never really got back to that level where he was ready to fight Oscar.
Nope.
Like, he was on pay-per-view soon. You know, he was still on pay-per-view. He had two fights with Shane. He had the fight with Mayorga. Like, yep. You know, he was still prominently featured, but he was never really able to recapture anything like that afterwards. You know, he was kind of shot.
Well, every time you saw him after that and he didn't have a fight sign, he was large.
Yeah. Oh, very much so.
Every time.
I was working with Showtime when I first moved out here, and that's when the Mayorga fight was first announced, and they were going through the press conferences. I wasn't at the one in LA or in Cali, wherever it was out there where the actual like blows were thrown. That was when the one in New York, they had a plexiglass between them. I was there for that. Yeah, and like
the old Bo Jorge Luis Gonzalez special.
Yeah. And I was watching that one. I still got pushed away by security as they tried to like intervene between them because they were about to go at it. That was a crazy scene.
Yeah, he's like hitting the glass.
Yeah. That was my first press conference I had ever been to. I was like a wide-eyed kid. I was 22 and I'm just going,
oh like, shit. So this is what it's like.
Yeah, I was like that, you know. Literally, bro, I was a month and a half out of college, and here I am at a press conference for Mayorga and Vargas. It was the coolest thing ever.
Hell yeah.
But one I wanted to bring up too, and I'm sure you're gonna laugh at this one because it's something we can both like crack up on, is that, you know, one thing you should never do in a fight, right, is try to get overly braggadocious, I guess, and start really taunting your opponent and start being an asshole, right? Do you think I know where I'm going with this?
I hope so.
So it was a guy that, I mean, I was a big fan of him back in the day, but, you know, he kind of really, really, really messed up in this fight, and that's Nate Campbell.
Oh,
it's Robbie. Yeah. If you want to talk about funny and ironic and just you have to clown on him for whatever happened that fight, it doesn't get brought up much anymore, if you really think about it. When's the last time you really heard about it, or if it gets like clips of shown on boxing Twitter or anything?
Probably me posting it.
Yeah, it's been a minute, right? It's not a fight that gets brought up often. And considering what happened in it and how funny it was, and like, it should get more attention.
Well, especially because Nate Campbell was like, you know, I remember reading about him in Ring like years before that. And I remember like, he was big on the Florida amateur scene.
Yeah.
Like, sure. He's still friends with like a bunch of, you know, like Florida fighters and shit like that. So I mean, I remember reading about him for a while.
I was a big fan of him when I saw him on I forgot what pay-per-view it was, but when I saw him ice Daniel Alisea on a pay-per-view back in the day, that was really impressive. Not to say that Alisea was like a major killer or nothing, but he was a good contender back in the day, a tough guy. Yeah,
I saw that Casimir fight at Pachanga. That was
oh, like, you were there?
That was at like 2001, 2002-ish.
Were you there?
Yeah.
Oh, no shit. That's pretty awesome.
Maybe 2003. God, I'd have to look. I don't know.
But well, that's when Casamayor, man. That's what I love about him. He wanted all the smoke back then. Think about everybody that there was around. He literally would fight anybody.
Yeah.
Think about
that was a good fight. Because, lot of people thought Campbell won that fight.
I thought he did too. But that just showed you like Campbell's, because Campbell was taking a major step up at that point too. He did have a amount of fights, but Casamayor was on a whole nother level than what he was at. And he hung with them tooth and nail up until the end. Because like you said, it was a very, very close fight.
Yeah.
But so from there, you know, Campbell was a known commodity at lightweight. It was popular because he was a braggadocious dude and he had a good personality. And combining with him, Mabel, and knock a dude clearly out. So when he was going to fight Robbie Peden, Robbie Peden was a good contender from Australia, a tough guy that was like, you know, featherweight, junior lightweight in the late 90s, early 2000s, and had a very, very good record, had a good record for himself, and was a really tough guy. But whenever he had really stepped up at that point, he'd kind of like fallen apart. I want to say the Marquez fight was before that, right?
Definitely. Yes.
Okay. And that was probably his most memorable fight. That was on HBO Boxing After Dark. He gave Marquez a good fight. He was competitive throughout it. And I mean, Marquez was clearly ahead throughout the fight, but Peden gave a good account of himself. But
wound up vomiting blood in his corner.
Yeah, he ended up puking blood clearly all over the place in the corner. You know, infamously, you just that's what Juan Manuel Marquez can do to you. But that's what Peden was probably most known for.
It was brutal.
So, I want to say this was for a vacant title, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was some, if there wasn't a title on this one, I'm pretty sure there's a title in the rematch.
Okay, but yeah, all right, you're probably
right. I'd have to look. I don't remember for sure, but yeah.
Anyway, yeah, okay. So, but in this fight, I think Campbell was in control for the majority of it, and that's why he started his taunting. You know what I mean? Yeah, Peden was doing that. That's when he started sticking his tongue out, sticking his chin out, sticking his chin out, sticking his tongue out, and then boom! Out goes the lights.
Yeah, dude, he had just hurt Robbie Peden real bad with a body shot. Like, he had just like ripped him with a body shot, and that's why Robbie Peden, like, he leans down and he's covering up his body because he got him real good. And then Peden tried to kind of like surprise him as he did that, and that's why Nate Campbell stood up with his gloves down like, bitch, you know, like he was trying to be like, what?
Yeah.
You know, like, what the fuck are you gonna do? But he just lost sight, dude. And it's from like a tactical standpoint, it's actually something you could learn from, because it's literally just Robbie Peden sticking his head down so that you can't see what his hands are doing. Mm-hmm. And so by the time that he moves his head, there's already a punch coming toward you, and it's kind of like a weird uppercutty looking thing. And Nate just didn't even see it whatsoever. His head damn near came clean fucking off, dude. Shit was awful.
That was a vicious knockout, my dude. Yeah.
I think you can look and see the clips, but almost all of the clips that you see, like on YouTube, for instance, are like they're from the Fox News or the Fox News, fucking Fox Sports replays. And it'll say nothing but knockouts on the, says like,
yeah.
But if you, I've posted more of like the actual, you know, the fight footage before. I don't know if I post the interview, but the interviews, like, actually at the time I was laughing my ass off, of course, because it was like this had just happened, and I watched it live and was like, holy shit, this is hilarious. But now, you know, of course, looking back, it's like really sad. Max Kellerman is sitting there trying to talk to Nate Campbell afterwards, and they're like, you know, again, just stop interviewing fighters who just got blasted. But Nate Campbell is like fighting back, sobbing, and he's trying to ask him like, can you explain to us what happened? And Nate Campbell's like, you know, like, oh, trying to not sob, and he's like, I got caught. I was laughing my ass off, but now looking back, I'm like, wow, this is sad,
because it's like messed up when you do that. Like when Darrell got like inadvertently knocked out by Abraham.
Yeah.
And they're like, you asked him, so what happened? I mean, like, Jim Gray came right up to him, and
there's like 19 people talking to him, and he's like confused, like just woke up. What the fuck? And
like, yo, and he's his eyes watery. I felt so bad for him. He's like, I got knocked out, man. And they're like, no, you won. And he has no idea what that, he just got.
Yeah. And he's sitting there going, everybody shut up. Cause there's like 19 people going,
or the OG clip, Pat, with Marlon Starling against Thomas Malianaris, where
I didn't get knocked out.
I didn't get knocked out. And then Larry Merchant, you know, famously says, you only have to be down for 10 seconds, Marlon.
Well, but he didn't have me down.
Yeah, you know. Like,
yeah, but he didn't help me down. Yeah, he starts arguing.
Yeah. It's absolutely wild.
Yeah, dude, it's a bad idea. Just stop interviewing fighters when they're concussed. Let's stop. dude, you actually brought this one up. And so I'm going to steal it from you. Hopefully I'm not stealing your last one, but I just, dude.
Nah, I have a good one.
Okay, good. The translator.
Translator?
Okay, good. So that, all right. Yeah. All right.
Oh, so, no. I know where you're going with this. Yeah, okay, no.
Just making sure.
Yeah, please. You're better to talk about this than I am.
So, damn, and now I'd have to double check because I fucking forgot to look which De La Hoya fight it was, but Julio Cesar Chavez versus Oscar De La Hoya, I think it was the rematch. This is the rematch.
You know what? All you have to do is mention Ray Flores and people are going to know that.
Yeah, Ray Torres, yeah.
Ray Torres. All you got to do is mention Ray. Yeah, I don't want to get the current guy in trouble. All you have to do is mention Ray Torres, who was pretty faint. You know, if you watched any type of boxing pay-per-view back in the 90s and early 2000s, you heard him as an interpreter. So, and as if you knew that, you knew he was probably doing some bungling of words.
Yes. And on top of that, dude, there's a couple of like actual translation issues here, like cultural issues here, because if I'm not mistaken, Ray Torres is Puerto Rican and Julio Cesar Chavez, Mexican. I mean, I'm not saying that a Puerto Rican cannot communicate with a Mexican, but sometimes slang means different things. Sometimes there are certain words that mean different things, or it might mean something stronger in one version of Spanish than the other, etc. And that's kind of what happened here. But Ray Torres, throughout his tenure at HBO, I think he's probably a good guy, probably a nice guy, but there were a handful of like key mistranslations that he did over the years.
I just liked his voice. He had like a type of voice that was kind of like high and
animated.
Animated
with his translations. Animated, so. Yeah, like, and he'd do like the inflections, like he wasn't just like,
yeah,
and I, hit him and with I, the jab, hit him with the right hand. Come on, you're gonna get him.
Like, you know,
come on, you're gonna get him here.
I couldn't, you could barely hear what they were saying because they were so monotone. I enjoyed him, yeah.
Go ahead and hit him with the jab. You're getting to him. Come on.
Yeah, you're like, come on, you gotta do this right now. Hit him. Yeah. Now double jab with the right hand.
Yeah, he'd just like, get like, even if what he was saying was incorrect, he'd get the inflection and it was like fun.
He got me hyped as a kid. Whenever I would hear him, I would get excited because whenever Oscar, one of them dudes were fighting, I'm like, oh shit, all right, my man's getting on the translation.
Well, like in one of the best ones was Eric Morales, Zahir Rahim. Let me put some water on your balls. That was the infamous put some water on your balls fight. Another one was, I think it was after round two in Ricardo Mayorga versus Vernon Forrest 1, where like their heads came together at some point and yeah. Mayorga goes to his corner and he says that this dude has hair that's really hard. Like his head's really hard because we came together. And he goes, that black guy, he hits hard.
I remember that.
And I remember just going like, what did he just say? Like this fucking guy, but he almost got killed. He almost got killed by Julio Cesar Chavez. I mean, Julio Cesar Chavez looked like, you know, he was about to damn near strangle Ray Torres. So after he quits in the corner, or the fight gets stopped as Julio Cesar Chavez in the corner, because he's cut up real bad against Oscar De La Hoya. And so then afterwards they go backstage and they're interviewing Julio Cesar Chavez and they're trying to figure out, you know, Larry Merchant's there and he's trying to figure out like, you know, what happened, what, you know, what exactly happened, you know, in the corner there, blah, 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 who, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And so Ray Torres is basically translating, but he's, the way that he's translating is that he's repeating what Larry Merchant says, but it's almost as if he's saying it like it's him asking it. You know, and it was just that, like, it was a bad miscommunication. So he's trying to say, like, is it true that you gave up in the corner? But the way that he asks it is he's basically like, you gave up in the corner. So, and like, as if he's stating it, you know what I mean? And Javier goes, bullshit, bullshit, and starts fucking getting heated. And so the second Ray Torres tries to like go, no, 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 and puts his hand on his shoulder, Julio Cesar Chavez just like, get your fucking hand off me, and starts smacking his hand off. And I was like, wow, bro, something's about to go down. Mm-hmm. Luckily, nothing did. Somehow it got smoothed over and Chavez did not order a hit on anybody. But that night, Ray Torres almost died. He came so close.
If Chavez lost, he always got animated in his interviews. All right. Well, so that would have been his fourth loss, right?
I think so. Yeah. So Frankie Randall.
Yeah, because he lost to Willie Wise after the rematch.
Yeah. So that was like 2001 or some shit.
No, that was way.
I'm thinking of the Grover fucking what is
Grover Wiley. Yeah.
Yeah. Willie Wise was like 97 or 98.
So yeah, he lost to Randall first, and then he lost to Oscar after that, and then, okay. So yeah, but. He whenever he would lose, I don't remember the interview after the first Oscar fight. I think he blamed it on fucking Julio Jr. blooding him up in a play sparring with him. But that's how he said he could, like, remember how he like started bleeding like a stuck pig in the first round of their first fight. And he said he blamed that on his kid like play fighting with him or something like that, which I think was Julio Jr., not Omar. And then but like you said, dude, he always, like, in the first fight with Frankie Randall, when he lost that, and he absolutely lost his mind, and his interpreter back then was, I forgot her name, but it was a female lady who was pretty popular because of Chavez back then, because she was known for him, like, working with him, and she was pissed, even more so pissed off than Chavez was, because she was going in, that's it, that Richard Steele, I'm gonna sue him, I'm gonna do this and that, I was a slip, I didn't lose, what low blows, I did nothing, like, they were losing their minds. Chavez was a sore loser, that's what people started turning off with him, because he was such a great fighter and all that other stuff, but when he started losing, he became a big baby.
There were a lot of excuses.
Oh, tons of them, man. So, you know. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
but that one was like Chavez went out on a shield against De La Hoya in the rematch. Like, I got to give him credit for that. Like, he put up a very good fight. De La Hoya was probably was around his peak and, you know, his absolute prime.
Yeah, he got cut up. Yeah, I mean, like,
he did. By he just that got time... absolutely sliced up, but he gave his all, but he was completely washed. And
yeah, he was outsized. You know, he got cut up. He was not.
He was older, and he had a lot of outside, and he had a lot of outside activities that wasn't going to help him against De La Hoya at that point.
Exactly. So. Exactly. So, I mean, you know, but even so, dude, it was
that was hysterical.
A great moment in translator history, that's for sure.
And then, so, like, I'll mention a couple of, like, just many ones before. I'll just say the one that, like, personally for me, which was always funny, but, like, all of them are called. Not for all of his issues. Poor guy. He's had a lot of issues going on. But after he beat Lennox Lewis the first time, all right, HBO doesn't really show it because it cuts off so absolutely quickly, but it is one of the most funniest post-fight interviews you will ever see. You see McCall there celebrating, going wild. You see all of Don King's cronies behind him wilding out too. Everybody's just celebrating, cheering, all that, right? Larry Merch is trying to talk to him, and they're like, do you think this would have been... And he's like, do you think this was a good stoppage? And they're like, what do you think would have happened if the fight would have... He would have been down for good. You hear me? And he was like, do you think this fight would have been stopped? What? What do you want me to do? Kill the man? See, that's what's wrong with his sport. Rah, 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 rah. And then he starts yelling, all of Don King's boys in the background yelling, rah, 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 like going crazy and stuff like that. And it's funny. And then they just completely just cut off because they're just going like in hysterics. And like.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's really, really funny. It lasts less than like 30 seconds, but it's the funniest thing you'll see. Like McCall's face, like he just gets so animated looking at Merch. He goes, what? What you want me to do? Kill the man? See, that's what's wrong with everybody. And then the other one I was going to say really quickly was after another thing I found on YouTube was after Tyson Ruddick 2, I want to say. Don King starts attacking Ferdy Pacheco, starts wilding, like getting really, really mad at him about like his commentary during the fight. And King and Pacheco's trying to interview Don King, and Don King is wilding. He's like, just be fair, Ferdy. You talked about a lot of stuff. You weren't giving the, he was like, you weren't talking about this, low blows, you know. And Ferdy is like trying to stay professional and trying to like, you know, trying to blow it up, but Don keeps on attacking him and really going at him. And so he's like, I'm catching some abuse over here. He's like, that's right. You're catching some blows because you're trying to be fair. Just be fair, Ferdy. Just be fair. That's Don King yelling at him, right? He was like, all right, man, I'm here with Mike Tyson. Do you want to fight Holyfield here? Don, we don't want Holyfield next. I ain't taking this. Man, all right, you talk about this, Ferdy. You won't talk about the other one, but you talk about this one. It was going on and on and on. So I guess it was still recorded after the show. That's when you start hearing Ferdy Pacheco and him and Steve Alvar are talking. Yeah, yeah, it was a great show. Azuma Nelson was great. Fennec was great. Blah, blah, blah.
Did you hear that? Don King?
That Don King, effing King, man. What the fuck was going on? I'm so mad. Damn mad. That, that King, what was wrong with him? Aye, aye. Like, I mean, it's hilarious. It's on YouTube. I mean, I think it's still on YouTube. I hope it is. It's hysterical. But what I wanted to say was, it's, and this is my favorite moment because this is what made me into a hardcore fan. And it's actually George Foreman, Michael Moore. And it's not actually the fight. It's just the what happened with it, right? So I'm watching this fight with my dad. And Foreman obviously is getting his ass kicked and stuff like that. But like, it's, you know, I'm still watching it because I'm watching it with him. And I'm just like, we're both cheering for Foreman, even though it's like a losing effort at this point. And I think we had some kind of family function going on because we had some people over. My aunt wanted to go home. And even though she only lived like a 10-minute, not even 10-minute walk away from us, it was dark out. So she asked my dad to drive her home. And he figured, you know, whatever, Foreman's losing. Ain't gonna take a minute to take her back. So he decides to leave, right? It's like round 8 when he decides to do that or something. So obviously, by round 10, I'm with my mom, and then Foreman knocks out Moore. You know, boop, 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 flattens him. I lose my shit completely, right, as I would. I'm a kid. This was 94. Yeah, yeah, I'm 10 years old. I'm losing my mind. I'm just screaming, yelling. I'm just, like, going absolutely bananas because that was the coolest thing I had ever seen in my life. So when my dad pulls up, I run outside, and he doesn't know what's going on. My mom's trying to hold me back, like, because it's late out. And she was like, I'm like going wild. And she's like trying to hold me. My dad's like, what's going on? What's happening? I start screaming, new champ, new champ. You messed up. He knocked him out. Oh my God. Ah! Like, I'm just going crazy. And he was like, what the hell? What are you talking about? And he kind of snatches me and he drags me. And we go into the house and he goes down the stairs and he sees the interview and sees everybody cheering. I'll never forget his reaction because he had never seen him get this mad in his life. And he calls on my aunt, which her name is Helen. He goes, oh my God. He goes, Helen, I'm going to kill her. I'm going to kill her. I missed this. My God, I missed it. And I never forgot that. Like he lost it. He was so angry. And I was still bouncing around like crazy that he won. And everything was just like, you know, it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
It's pretty fucking good, dude. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, that was what transformed me into being a super fan of the sport. Like literally, that was the night. That
couldn't whole you have just thing, right Helen? There. Helen, could you have just walked, man? Come on.
He got so mad, and seeing the way he reacted for some reason elevated me even more. Because I knew I saw something special. I guess you know what I mean. Like I already felt I saw something special when it happened, but to see the way
he's that reacted, mad that he missed it. Yeah.
Yeah. To see the way he reacted made me realize even more so that it was like kind of like, wow.
Fucking hell, man. That's good shit though, dude.
Yeah. It was awesome. I couldn't believe, like, I just knew I was just like, I didn't go to sleep that night. I was just running around like a maniac going crazy, screaming about George Foreman. Now I wanted to be George Foreman.
I was going to say, dude, since the little one that you brought up about Don King, I thought you were going to mention him drunkenly falling off the ring.
Well, that needs to be mentioned before we go, bro, because yeah. That is one of the most hysterical things you'll ever see. Because
nobody even knows. Nobody, I'd never seen it. And then you showed it to me and I was like, what is Don King?
I told you, know, thank you for bringing that up. I almost forgot. What was that? Was that the first or second Areola fight? Areola's Taverne fight?
I think it was the first. I think
you're right. I think it was the first.
But King was acting the fool for that shit in general, just like acting a total, like during the entire promotion. So yeah, I think it was the first.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You're totally right. And again, that was another fight. I worked for Punch Zone, and it was afterwards. If you see it, like they're interviewing Stavert. That's what they're doing. Yeah. But it was, Bob Papa was interviewing Stavern ringside after the fight, and then you just hear this commotion, and then you look, you see Don King in his denim jacket arguing with some poor intern, or I don't know who it was, some girl that's on stage with him, and he's like tugging with her and somebody else, and Dan Goose and the late great Dan Goosen's over there trying to like mediate it or something, and you hear audibly Don King yell, "Are you out of your fucking mind? What the fuck's going on over here?" Like, and then the man falls. He fell off the ring.
At this point, he's like 82. Like,
he was in his 80s at this point, probably in the mid 80s. You just hear him blop, and he just goes dropping down.
And all told, it was about as graceful as it could happen. I mean, honestly. I mean,
seriously, a person at his age and in Dodge shapes had no business landing that gracefully at that point.
I mean, definitely. Honestly, it could have been worse.
But what makes it even better, the most perfect way, after he lands and he kind of like, you know, just kind of bum rushes the interview out, like, because of that, because he, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like he recovers. He's just like, all right, now back to bitching.
And all of a sudden he looks up. And then they go, Bob Hopper's like, "You okay, Don?" And Don goes, "I am now."
And then that was a pretty smiling. Good Don King impersonation.
It is absolutely hysterical. He looks, and you can tell he's like distressed. He goes, "I am now." And then, awesome. And then he puts on the big grin. Yeah.
Fucking Don King, bro. Bless him. Bless him. I hope he lives forever.
I mean, you know, dude, evil doesn't die, dude. Does it?
No. No. So, he'll live forever for sure. He's embalmed or something. But hey, dude,
you think he's gonna get the Canelo fight?
Oh no, nah, dude. I think Canelo's probably gonna move on. He's got too many other. Now, I mean, I don't know if that whole thing was just a ploy to see what his options were. What I honestly have
That's
no.
That's a
idea.
Weird ploy, though. Call him Macabre of all people.
Yeah, that's strange. Especially
doesn't seem
to,
like,
you know,
something Canelo would do. I think he actually had interest in it, and then he just kind of like.
Well, maybe they had interest in it until they realized Don King wanted to be involved. You know, that much involved, and then they were like, you know, maybe not. But I don't know. I kind of doubt.
Man. As much of a bad person Don King is, and he is, and he just. What he's done with boxing, evil, whatever. And you can't deny that he's not a good person, but it would have been entertaining. And I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but it would have been entertaining to see him one last time in a big, big, big promotion.
Yeah. I mean, and hey, dude, if that's where it goes and that's what Canelo decides to do, like, I'm watching. Of course I'm watching.
I'm going to watch. And I'm going to watch Don with all of his flags and his frayed out denim jacket, which I've seen up close.
Viva Mexico! Viva Mexico! Like, it'll be awful, you know? It'll be terrible.
Absolutely terrible. Such as boxing, man. People like that, they just never go away.
Yeah, but you know what, though, dude? One of the great things about this shit is that, you know, a decade later, 20 years later, we're sitting here remembering some of the most hilarious shit we've ever experienced in our lives. Mm-hmm. Because of, you know, and some of the most enjoyable shit too. Unfortunately, some of it comes at the expense of some of these funders.
Well, we didn't even mention some of the, like, really, like, you know, we could have mentioned the whole Zab Judah episodes that he's had, or Mike Tyson talking spinal, and
yeah,
all, I mean, these other things.
Those,
like,
are the usual, the
those
usual,
are the usual ones that people.
We had some pretty good ones though, I think.
Oh, very, very, very. Yeah, man, I had a blast doing this. This was a lot of fun. And just like lighthearted, we didn't have to talk about people murdering each other or, you know, going through history today. It was cool.
And we'll get back to that. I'm sure we will. We love those stories too. But, you know, for the time being, it's nice to kind of have a little pick me up, you know, a little job. You know what I'm saying? But, hey, dude, I appreciate you taking the time to do it, man. And I hope everybody listening in had a good time themselves. We appreciate you watching or listening in as well. You know, it's always a good time
always.
Doing this.
Love
show.
It. Yep.
Speaking of which, though, if you did watch this, for instance, on YouTube, we would appreciate it if you went ahead and subscribed to the Knuckles and Gloves podcast, or if you listen in any of the podcast apps, go ahead and subscribe that way. Anyway, whichever way you do, go ahead and leave a comment or a review. Those things are helpful, and as far as, you know, ticking us up the search kind of results or whatever, I don't know, it makes it look cool, makes us maybe get some sort of sponsor or something like that, right, Aris? Something
Absolutely.
That's like Manscaped. No. No, we do appreciate it. We really do. And also, if while you're waiting for this next episode to come out, if you're on social media, for instance, like Twitter, go ahead and go on to Twitter and follow my dude Aris Pina at Punch Zone Aris. Follow me Patrick Connor at Patrick M. Connor. If you're also on like Facebook or Instagram, we're also there too. Go ahead and give us a follow there, and we'll talk to you guys soon. Aris, talk to you soon, bro.
All right, man. Always a pleasure. Thanks, everyone.
Later, people.